Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome to the program Gabriel Silva Luján. He is the Colombian ambassador to the United States, former defense minister of Colombia, former CEO of the Colombian Coffee Federation. He was recently here talking to the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Marie Charlotte, thank you very much for having me, and thank you for this coffee. It's actually delicious.
Good. I hope it's Colombia.
Very nice.
So you were here talking about the U.S. debt crisis and the way that is perceived in the in Latin America. One of the things that I think that the U.S. media never really talks about or thinks about is the way that we as a nation are perceived by other countries. What's the Colombian perspective and the Latin American perspective on what we're doing here?
Well, it's difficult to generalize, but I have to tell you that in Latin America, people were surprised and concerned with the way in which the issue of the debt was handled, such a critical issue that affects not only the U.S. but the world in general. And the perception was that the situation was not handled in the right way, and the last-minute solution, thank God, was achieved, but still in the region, that created a feeling of lack of credibility and the ability of the U.S. to solve its problems. And that's hurting the region and hurting the relationship between the North and South America. And I think that credibility has to be restored. And a very important way to restore that credibility is to make sure that the commitments that the U.S. have with the region are really achieved. And in particular, I mean, for example, the FTA agreement between Colombia and the U.S. and the FTA agreement between Panama and the U.S. The region is watching what's going to happen with those agreements to see if the U.S. is going to deliver on them.
When we talk about free trade agreements, I mean, we see NAFTA, and NAFTA has been a mixed blessing for people, certainly in Mexico. There are so many stories about farmers who have lost their land. There's so many stories about Mexicans having to eat genetically modified corn because their local corn is no longer economically viable, and so on. What is positive about a free trade agreement, not from the perspective of the United States, but from Colombia's perspective?
Well, in general, Colombia is a country that feels very comfortable with the U.S., both politically and economically. Colombia and the U.S. are very complementary. We don't compete basically in any areas. And that's why the Colombians support widely the approval of the FTA between the two countries. Actually, what the U.S. exports to Colombia, we don't produce. And it's the same in the case of Colombia.
Coffee, so cocaine.
Well, I'm talking about the legal ones. We can talk about drug trafficking later because significant progress has been made in that issue also. But if you see, we export coffee, flowers, tropical fruits, energy. We are a key exporter of energy to the U.S. So it's a very complementary relationship, and the Colombian people support in general that FTA. Actually, Colombia has had free trade access to the U.S. through the References Act, has been there for 20 years. So the FTA, what it does is to level the field, the playing field for the U.S. companies, because they have been paying tariffs while Colombian companies have not. So it's a way to achieve symmetry. Why we want that symmetry? Because an FTA will give certainty about this relationship, certainty in the political front and certainty in the commercial or trade front. And you know that certainty is a very valuable commodity, and a very valuable aspect if you want to invest in a country, if you want to develop a business.
One of the things, of course, that has hung up the free trade agreement regarding Colombia is issues about labor, Colombia being one of the most dangerous places for a trade unionist to to live and to work, especially trade union leaders?
Well, I think that one of the reasons labor leaders in the U.S. have opposed the Colombian FTA is on the basis of labor rights and the protection of labor leaders. But I think they are stuck in the past. They are seeing the Colombia of 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Things have changed dramatically and are changing very fast currently. The Colombian indicators, for example, of violence have diminished dramatically. Certainly we still have violence, but at levels that are comparable to any other country in the region, actually less than other countries like Mexico or Brazil. And so we are stuck with a stereotype that's hurting because it doesn't reflect the current reality. President Santos has a very progressive agenda. He passed a reparation law to compensate the victims of violence. He passed a land reform law and a land restitution law to protect farmers and victims of displacement. He created a new Ministry of Labor that we didn't have. And he just in April signed an agreement with the U.S., an action plan on labor rights. It's a joint effort between the U.S. and Colombia to fulfill certain milestones in guaranteeing the protection of labor leaders and labor rights. The U.S. government has certified or have complied with all and every milestone in that action plan to protect labor rights. So I think that sometimes labor leaders in the U.S. are even behind Colombian labor leaders. I can show you several statements by Colombian labor leaders saying that President Santos and his government had made significant progress and that this action plan to protect labor rights is the most advanced plan set of legislation and actions in the last 20 years. So of course, there's still issues, there's still violence, but we have expanded our protection program. We provide protection to labor leaders, activists, and even to leaders who are organizing for the first time a union. And none of the members of the unions that have been protected have been threatened or killed. So it's effective. Also, we're going to bring the ILO, the International Labor Organization, to provide special assistance to Colombia to strengthen our labor laws. So I think that you can say Colombia is still a violent country. Yes, it is. And they kill union members in Colombia. Yes, they do also in the U.S. They don't account for them because they're killed for many other reasons. But at the same time, Colombia has a commitment and a political will to protect labor leaders. And things are improving dramatically. I fear that sometimes behind that argument, what is really behind it, is the fear and the usual reluctance of the labor movement in the U.S. towards free trade.
Reluctance in the movement toward free trade because basically they want protectionism?
Well, I think that if you see the numbers, the figures, the statements, and the actions related to labor rights in Colombia in the last years, in particular in the last year since President Santos has been in power, everything shows significant progress. And actually, the AFL-CIO in several statements have acknowledged that President Santos has made tremendous progress and there's a new attitude and a new will. And I think that if that's the case, and they are saying so, I think it gets stuck in the past. Talking about things that happened 10 years ago is not fair with Colombia.
Well, 10 years ago was a really different time in Colombia. I mean, the amount of change that has happened in the last 10 years is really striking. And one of them is, I mean, not just around labor leaders, but the amount of violence in general, murder, kidnapping, and so on, has decreased amazingly. How was that accomplished?
Well, I think that the Colombians decided through democratic means by electing a president and a program to fight terrorism, drug trafficking, and illegal organizations. And the country as a whole supported that program. And it was successful because of that. And also because Colombians did a tremendous sacrifice in terms of resources. Sometimes in the U.S. people believe that Colombia fights drugs because it's a request from the U.S. or because the U.S. gives us some money. Actually, U.S. aid, that is very important from the technical point of view, is less than 5% of the budget assigned by Colombia to fight illegal drugs and organized crime. Even our business community did a tremendous effort, paid taxes for this purpose, and the Colombians put their money where their mouth was, and they paid for their, to beef up their security and to defeat terrorism. Of course, we're still fighting, we're still moving ahead, but as you said, and I thank you for acknowledging it, Colombia was without hope 10 years ago. People were leaving the country by the thousands. And now, if you ask any Colombian, hope is back, and people are seeing a bright future for the country and for themselves.
Yeah, I'm about ready to go there and take a salsa dancing tour.
It's the time to go.
It's the time to go. So, on the subject of the drug war, first of all, does Colombia have a drug addiction problem the way we do here?
Well, it has grown fast, and I will tell you why. Because the export of illegal drugs has diminished dramatically because of the success in interdiction and the success to fighting organized crime. Actually, Colombia also diminished dramatically the cultivation of illegal crops that have moved elsewhere. We still have some, but the trend continues to be smaller. But at the same time, these illegal organizations are trying to create a domestic market to replace those huge rents they usually receive from exporting drugs.
Primarily to the U.S.
Primarily to the U.S. They're trying now to replace those illegal rents with other illegal rents extracted from Colombians and extracted from extortion, illegal gold mining, from selling drugs in poor barrios. So this is like the remnants, and we're victims of the success. But again, that's a process in which we are involved strongly to avoid combat these expressions of these new expressions of the efforts of organized crime to keep the Colombians involved in drugs.
One of the things that we've talked about many times on this program is the whole question of drug legalization. So if, in other words, comparing it to prohibition of alcohol in the United States, that was how organized crime made a ton of money. You get rid of prohibition, you re-legalize alcohol, it's regulated, that part of organized crime goes away. What's your view on the legalization of drugs and Colombia?
Well, from a theoretical perspective, the rents generated by the illegality the legal market of drugs will be diminished by legalization. But you know, that's a discussion that in Colombia has little echo, because for Colombians the issue is deeper than that, because the issue is that organized crime, terrorism, feeds itself on these rents, these illegal rents, and they have an agenda to take over the country. They almost took over the country several decades back, and our fight is to defend the Colombian democracy and the Colombian people from a criminal enterprise. And that criminal enterprise has to be destroyed. And it has to be submitted to justice. Because if not, today is drugs, tomorrow is kidnapping, after tomorrow will be illegal gold mining. They will find a way to nurture their illegal designs or their criminal designs. So we need to really first dismantle. And waiting for legalization to help us is too far down the road. So
right.
We need to act right now.
So that's an incredibly difficult job, because as we know from the Mexican cartels, they have way more money and firepower than the police.
Well, we are working very closely with the Mexican authorities. Colombia's experience has been tough. 3 years ago, actually, when I was in government for the first time, you went out of your office and you know you were going to arrive alive at home, because these organized crimes were so powerful and the state was so weak. But we, with a lot of discipline and patience, built institutions that now can confront effectively these organized criminals And you need to have a tremendous political will to achieve that and keep the course. And you'll get there, because no one can defeat the state if the state has the support of the people and the will to fight back.
We're talking to Gabriel Silva Luján, the Colombian ambassador to the United States. So let's go back to the issue of free trade agreements. You're here in New Mexico. Are there economic ties between Colombia and the state of New Mexico?
Well, I think that Colombia and New Mexico share a lot in common. We are a very diverse society as New Mexico. We have a tremendous influence and relevance of the indigenous population, and we have a cultural tradition that spreads for centuries back to the Spaniards and our cultural heritage, common cultural heritage. And I think that there's a lot of potential. Part of that potential is diminished by the fact that New Mexico, as any other state in the U.S., is limited in its access to Colombian market because of tariffs. And I will quote two numbers that are very important. If the FTA was approved, the New Mexican exporters to Colombia, 60% of them will see tariffs removed immediately. And also, the U.S. International Trade Commission issued a report that says that exports from New Mexico to Colombia will grow in average 50% once the FTA is approved. So it's relevant for creating jobs in New Mexico.
What kind of New Mexican products do Colombians want?
Well, we have we buy cotton, we buy minerals, we buy also welding technologies from certain companies around the area. And there's a lot of potential for other areas of increased trade.
Chilies?
We love New Mexican chilies.
Do you?
Yes. Actually, I love Santa Fe, New Mexico. I have been here before, and I love this area.
So the whole question of Latin America as a region, not only Colombia, but the countries of South and Central America, how are you as nations communicating with one another, making informal and formal political and economic agreements with one another? What's going on?
I think that the last year, and I have to say that in part because of President Santos' leadership, the animosities that characterized some of the relations in the region a few years back have diminished. Now there is an effort by all countries to try to find ways to solve the differences. And I want to mention one in particular, Colombia and Venezuela. Now Colombia has a foreign policy that engages Venezuela in a very effective way. President Santos and President Chavez have met several times and worked together. They worked together to solve the crisis in Honduras and to find a path forward in that country. And so it has been very convenient. On the economic side, Colombia has just signed further liberalization for our markets between Chile, Peru, Mexico, and Colombia. And we are doing the same with other countries in the region. And there is an interest in Latin America for finding ways to work together. And somehow in an independent and autonomous way, because Colombia and the other countries in the region have changed dramatically. They are now more prosperous. They have new middle classes, and they have significant economic growth, and they have new clients. For example, I'll give you an interesting case. When I was ambassador the first time, ambassador to the U.S. 19 years ago, a long time ago now, China was our 22nd largest trade partner. Now it's our second largest trade partner. So I will encourage the U.S. and the U.S. citizens and leaders to consider that we need to have the U.S. that's engaged in the region. It's a positive agenda. It's really a win-win situation. Another example, we just signed and entered into force an agreement, a free trade agreement with Canada. Canada is now has duty-free access to the U.S., to Colombia, excuse me. that's going to kill American farmers in the Colombian market. The Canadians are going to take over, and because they're not paying any tariffs. And the U.S. is paying tariffs not because Colombia wants them to pay tariffs, but because the U.S. had not moved ahead at the right time in the FTA. We're still on time to do that, but there should be a sense of urgency.
What about Europe? What is Colombia and Latin America's relationship like with the EU?
Well, the EU has its own set of problems right now, but at the same time, they have strengthened their commercial ties with Latin America. Actually, we signed a free trade agreement with the European Union that should enter into force early next year. And I want to just go back to an issue about labor. You know that Canada and the European Union has one of the most stringent and most, I would say, strongest standards for labor law and labor protection. Both Canada and the European Union found that Colombia was sufficiently effective and sufficiently committed to protect labor laws and labor rights to the point that they agreed to sign the FTAs with us. So people ask why if the union leaders in Europe and the union leaders in Canada believe that our FTAs are worth approving and having, why the U.S. labor leaders don't see that. But again, going back to Europe, Europe is very active, in particular Spain. Spain has a tremendous presence in the region, both in the financial and the communications sector. But the region is receiving a lot of investment from many different parts of the world.
Now, you, this past year, have had tremendous flooding in Colombia, which washed away millions, if not billions, of dollars worth of infrastructure. Do you see this as a manifestation of climate change, global warming?
I love that question, because that's one of my concerns, personal concerns, and I have been involved in that issue in Colombia for many years. Actually, when I was in the Coffee Federation, Colombian Coffee Federation, we saw the effect of climate change. We used to have the average altitude for coffee growing at 1,200 meters. Now we have to raise that altitude to almost 1,500 or 1,600 meters. That's a significant change because of the warming. And clearly these floods are an expression of climate change. President Santos has set a commission to work on how to prepare the country to for these changes, and we have to acknowledge that these are going to be they're here to stay, and we need to adapt the country and the infrastructure and the different cities and different towns to change them and adapt them to confront these floods, because they're going to come back, unfortunately. They were devastating. 2 million people were affected, displaced, and the reconstruction is going to cost a fortune, several billion dollars.
The problem that nobody seems to really be addressing in an effective way is that the things we want, namely economic growth, industrialization, a prosperous middle class, those are all the causes of climate change.
Well, I think that Colombia is a good example of a balance. Colombia has close to 50% of its territory covered by jungle and natural vegetation, and most of it is under protected status. And clearly, that allows us the legitimacy to claim the right to develop it. Unfortunately, we don't see the same kind of commitment in other places, particularly in the developed world. There is less willingness to have that balanced approach. But Colombia is a strong actor in the international discussions of climate change, and we are on the side of those that ask and demand much better action and much more commitment from the industrialized world.
Tell us more about the current president of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos.
Well, President Santos is his career originated as a journalist. His family used to own the largest newspaper in Colombia, El Tiempo. He was the deputy editor for many years, and against the will of his family, he decided to accept a position in the government as Minister of Trade many years back. Then he was Minister of Finance and more recently Minister of Defense. He was a key actor in the outcome that we are discussing in terms of the increased security and increased safety in Colombia. He was a very effective Minister of Defense, and I think that part of the reason why people voted for him is because he showed his leadership and his ability to conduct these policies. At the same time, he's a liberal. He has a progressive tradition and agenda. He believed in the need to be very inclusive and to have a national reconciliation that in which everyone is part of, and that a national reconciliation in which every political force has something to contribute. Actually, almost all political forces in Colombia are represented in his cabinet. So it's a very inclusionary, a very open approach to politics and to public policy.
We have in this country right now a situation which is so politically divisive and divided that the two main parties in this country can barely communicate with each other anymore. Do you have that? You don't seem not to have that same problem in Colombia?
No, right now we have the president and the government has a very large majority in Congress. I mean, almost 85% of Congress is aligned with the government. Also, the president enjoys high popularity, 80% approval in the last poll of last week. So he's very popular. And we don't have that kind of acrimonious debate right now in Colombia. And we used to have it in the past, but not now.
For a long time, people didn't travel to Colombia because they were frightened to. Is there a tourist industry at this point?
Well, with the change in Colombia, I will say that change is similar to what happened in Eastern Europe. It's like when the Berlin Wall fell.
People, I went to Prague the next year.
Exactly. That's what is happening in Colombia. I think that violence was our Berlin Wall. Now that it has diminished dramatically, people are discovering a very rich country, very diverse country.
Where do your tourists come from?
Well, we have, now it has grown, has multiplied by 4 in the last 5 years. We are now reaching 2 million tourists per year. Come from Europe, from the US, from Canada, a lot from Latin America. But it's interesting that we had travel articles about Colombia in the most read travel sections in the U.S. newspapers, something that was unthinkable years back. And we have been highlighted as one of the top destinations by specialized magazines. So it has changed profoundly. We now have the cruise industry visiting Cartagena and other ports in Colombia. We didn't have that several years back. So it's a revival that's very useful for the country and very useful for us to spread the message that Colombia is a safe place, that Colombia is a beautiful place, and that Colombia is a place in which people love salsa and love to welcome Americans and foreigners.
Gabriel Silva Luján is Colombian ambassador to the United States. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Inshallah, thank you very much for the invitation. I really enjoyed it.
Colombia, qué linda y buena. Bogotá, Santa Marta, Barranquilla y Cartagena.
¡Buena! Colombia para arriba.
Qué linda y buena.
Échale para adelante.
Bogotá, Santa Marta, Barranquilla y Cartagena.
Colombia, me enamoré de tu belleza infinita, que el corazón me palpita y se me pone al revés. Lo cierto es que me llené de encantos por tu hermosura. Te parece tanto a Cuba que nunca te olvidaré. Oye,
Colombia,
Colombia para arriba, échale para adelante.
Bogotá, Santa Marta, Barranquilla y Cartagena.
Permíteme que te cante por los bonitas y elegantes. Soy uno de esos cantantes que adora tus maravillas, cantándole a Cartagena, Santa Marta, Barranquilla, Bogotá, Colombia para arriba. Con tremenda alegría de regresar algún día a esta tierra colombiana. Y cuando llegue mañana allá mi cubita buena, recordaré a Cartagena, que es igualita a La Habana. Por eso Colombia para arriba, échale para adelante,
Bogotá, Santa Marta, Barranquilla y Cartagena.
I'd like now to introduce to the program Eric Jantz. He's a staff attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate the opportunity.
So we like to check in with you guys every once in a while and see what's going on and see what you're doing to defend the environment of New Mexico. There was a hearing last week involving Mount Taylor and mining permits there, Mount Taylor being a sacred mountain to many different Native American groups. What's happening there?
Right. So the hearing last Wednesday involved a standby permit application for the Mount Taylor mine. It's it's an old uranium mine. It's been dormant for the last 20 years. It hasn't done any mining for the last 20 years. It mined for approximately 8 years since it originally opened. So it has extracted some resources, but it's been dormant for the vast majority of its life. And since it's been dormant, all the mine features and waste rock piles have been sitting and festering for many, many years. So the mine company, Rio Grande Resources, which is a division of General Atomics, requested another 5-year standby period where it can just let the mine sit for another 5 years. The Law Center represents a couple of conservation community groups who not necessarily oppose the standby permit, but wanted the Mining and Minerals Division, which regulates mining in New Mexico, to require some interim reclamation of the mine, most specifically an old waste rock pile that is sitting and contaminating groundwater at that mine site.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, there's a bigger picture of what happens when a mine is no longer in use, whether it's temporary or permanent, but when a mine is abandoned, and not cleaned up, what happens? And in this case specifically, is groundwater actively being contaminated? Do we know?
We do know. So when mines are inactive, now mining is a boom and bust industry. When the commodity price of whatever mineral is high, mines operate. When it's low, they shut down, either temporarily or permanently. And when they shut down, they need to be reclaimed if they shut down permanently, or they need to be tended to and have some interim reclamation if they shut down temporarily to make sure that the other resources aren't contaminated. I mean, mining is a heavy industry, and it pollutes. There's no way around that. But operators can take steps to reduce and in some cases eliminate pollution. So at the Mount Taylor mine, we do know that there is groundwater pollution. There's alluvial groundwater spreading across around 8 to 9 acres at the mine site that we know from groundwater monitoring data is polluted with uranium.
Is that getting into the drinking water supply of communities in that area?
At this point, no.
Uranium mining has long been a problem in terms of, I mean, on the one hand, there is job creation. On the other hand, there is a lot of illness that goes along with that job creation.
Yeah, that's right. And like I said, it's a boom and bust industry. Mining operations do create jobs. I mean, that's a matter of fact. But, you know, the jobs are temporary. The resource is finite. Eventually, those jobs go away. And you can see that Grants and Gallup are one-time boom towns that are now bust towns. And that's the case throughout the West. And that won't change. So, I mean, one of the sort of bigger picture issues that the community members are working on at the Law Center is supporting is long-term and sustainable economic growth through various kinds of sustainable and long-term energy development projects, sustainable agricultural, things like that. Things that will provide long-term economic benefits for the community, but also won't lead to these long-term environmental and public health impacts.
Mount Taylor is a place where there's a lot of uranium. There were millions and millions of pounds of uranium extracted from it when it was active. Then the price of uranium dropped, and there is thought to be or known to be way more uranium still left inside. What are the factors that determine whether or not mining companies want to take it out of the mountain?
Well, there are a number of factors that determine whether mining companies take uranium out of the ground. One is obviously the demand for uranium. And at this point, the International Atomic Energy Agency is projecting that worldwide demand for uranium can be satisfied with existing operations for the next 20 years at least. So really, there's no need to open any additional mines worldwide. And, you know, this is a global economy and it's a global commodity market. So it's questionable whether any new mines need to be opened at all. That said, the other things that go into the consideration of whether to open a mine are how much it costs a company to produce the uranium, whether there's a place to process the uranium, a uranium mill, and the price of the commodity itself.
As I was reading about this whole issue, I thought, you know, the thing that's going to determine uranium mining on Mount Taylor ultimately will be whether the price of solar energy can be brought to a place where it's competitive with coal.
Well, I think that's part of it, yeah. But, you know, it's interesting that the sort of energy calculus doesn't seem in a lot of ways to follow necessarily the strict economic trends. There are a lot of political policy considerations involved as well that not only influence where and how energy sources are used, but also, you know, the price of being able to use that energy. So, you know, for example, nuclear energy you know, is said to be by industry people to be competitive with renewable sources, but it's not a strictly free market equation there. The nuclear industry, from uranium mining to the processing plants to the power plants, get huge public subsidies. Without those public subsidies, would never be able to compete in the marketplace. It would just be far too expensive. So the bottom line price of generating energy is one consideration, but that's influenced in a lot of ways by public policy.
So basically, nuclear energy is the ultimate socialism.
Yes, it is. I mean, that's a good way to put it. It is the most socialized industry out there. It wouldn't exist without the largesse of government and taxpayers.
Let's talk about Mount Taylor and what it means to the people who live there. It was at some point designated as a traditional cultural property, but then that was reversed by a judge earlier this year. What's the cultural set of issues in Mount Taylor?
Well, Mount Taylor is an incredibly important cultural and spiritual mountain to the many of the tribes and pueblos in New Mexico and outside of New Mexico even. It's one of the four sacred mountains for the Navajo tribe that delineated the traditional homeland of the Navajos, where in their cosmology they emerged into this world from the third world. It's a very important culturally for the Acoma Pueblo, the Laguna Pueblo, and even tribes as far away as Arizona. The Hopi tribe consider it an important cultural mountain. So from a cultural perspective, it's incredibly important. Part of the reason for that is that because it's a significant source of watershed. It's the headwaters for Rio San Jose that flows into Acoma and has served for millennia as one of their major sources of irrigation. There are a lot of springs and natural sumps and seeps in the area. So, you know, it's been not only a cultural resource, as it were, but also a resource for sustenance. It's been a life-sustaining area for the people in that region for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Is there a way that it could be mined that would not ruin the water supply and the watershed that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on what you mean by ruin. I think that the complete destruction of the watershed, it's feasible. I mean, it's imaginable something like that could happen. I think there'd have to be a substantial amount of mining to do that. But that said, uranium mining isn't something that can be done in an environmentally sound manner. I mean, the nature of uranium mining and resource extraction generally is that it's a very dirty and polluting industry. So there is going to be some ground and surface water and soil and air pollution. I mean, that's business.
And with that comes increased rates of cancer and all sorts of illnesses.
Generally, yeah. There isn't a whole lot of information out there about the public health effects of mining, uranium mining. And I think that that's, in some respects, a conscious policy choice on the part of governments, because once it becomes clear that these industries are real public health problems, then it becomes less likely that they get the green light to go forward. That said, within the last 5 years or so, there have been some very interesting community-based public health studies that are beginning to show that the people who live in proximity to these sort of operations end up having a range of health problems, from increased rates of cancer to increased rates of autoimmune disease, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, things like that.
Is it mostly Native people who end up being the miners?
Well, not necessarily. It certainly is mostly low-income people who end up being employed in these type of projects, and these type of projects are generally located in communities that are low income and or of color, because, you know, frankly, these kind of projects don't get done in well-to-do communities.
We're talking to Eric Jantz of the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. So what actually happened at the public hearing last week?
Well, I think that the public hearing last week is sort of a hint of what's to come with this administration. Like I said, the Law Center represented two community groups, Amigos Bravos and the Multicultural Alliance for a Safe Environment, MACE, in that hearing. We tried to put on testimony to encourage the Mining and Minerals Division to implement some interim reclamation projects, because it does look like groundwater is being contaminated by an old waste rock pile from the mine. But the hearing officer wouldn't allow us to present any testimony on groundwater contamination or any sort of reclamation, interim reclamation measures. And that was based on the objection of the mining company. It's interesting that the mining company was able to present all its witnesses and all the testimony it intended to place, but the community members were shut down completely.
Who makes the rules about that?
Well, the hearing officer was the person who ran the meeting. And in a large part, the hearing officer has discretion to run the meeting the way he sees fit. That said, there are some rules. I think that the hearing officer didn't properly follow those rules, and we're going to bring those errors to his attention. And our hope is that we'll be able to present the testimony we were originally intended to present based on these identification of these procedural errors that the hearing officer committed.
These are little steps along the way, a temporary permit, 5-year extension, these kinds of things. But in the big picture, what do you see as most beneficial to the citizens of the state of New Mexico, both economically and environmentally, in terms of dealing with the many kinds of mining and mineral extraction that we have in the state of New Mexico?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that the big picture and long-term solution to New Mexico's economic issues is pretty obviously renewable resources. I mean, mining laws and extraction laws, oil and gas laws, those are artifacts of the 19th and early 20th century. They haven't changed that much, and the attitudes haven't changed that much. The attitude seems to be, and it's certainly the attitude with this administration, let's extract as much as we can. A few people get rich, and there's a lot of environmental contamination. I think that the way to start long-term and sustainable economic development in New Mexico is to start by cleaning up the mess of the last 100 years and then proceed to build and create a large and 21st century sustainable renewable energy infrastructure.
Eric, anything else that you want to let people know before we go?
Yeah, I think that it's worth mentioning that the Mining and Minerals Division is still taking written comments on the Mount Taylor Mine standby permit application until Thursday, September 1st. You can get more information on that at the Law Center's website, www.nmelc.org.
Eric Jantz is staff attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.